Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sacha Baron Cohen made his name, his fame, taking his act into the world as Ali G, as the faux Kazakh journalist Borat, as the flamboyant Austrian fashion reporter Bruno. His scripted characters often touch real-world headlines too. Admiral General Aladdin in The Dictator, and his latest madcap soccer hooligan in The Brothers Grimsby. It's a potent brand of humor he's found, if you can hang with him. This hour on Point, we're talking with Sacha Baron Cohen. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your question for actor, comedian, writer, provocateur? Sacha Baron Cohen. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a little clip from Sacha Baron Cohen's upcoming movie, The Brothers Grimsby. Here's Jody, played by Sacha Baron Cohen's actual wife, Isla Fisher, secretly instructing Nobby, who he plays, the soccer hooligan in the film, to seduce a woman for information.
You need to head inside, find Lena Schmidt, and seduce her.
What, and cheat on Donna? Never.
You need to seduce her in order to find out what Lukashenko bought from her husband.
Okay.
Can you see Lena Schmidt? She's easy to spot. She's wearing a green dress and she's absolutely gorgeous.
Sounds key. Things get pretty wild from there. Joining me now in the studio is Sacha Baron Cohen. He appeared in Sweeney Todd, Les Miserables, Madagascar, Hugo, Borat, Bruno, Ali G. He co-wrote and stars in the upcoming film The Brothers Grimsby. Sacha Baron Cohen, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you
Thank
here.
Thank you for having me here.
Wow. First of all, I have to say, you have made me laugh so much over the years. I feel actually sincere gratitude to you. I've bust a gut many, many times with your performances. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope you paid to see all of those experiences.
No, I downloaded everything, pirate sites.
Right. No thanks, just give me money.
No, I paid through the nose. And to sit down with you, to interview after all those years of Ali G, I was having kind of nightmares last night about Sacha Baron Cohen going all Ali G on me. Do you keep all these characters alive? Are they all accessible to you? Can you slip into Borat or slip into Bruno or slip into Ali G? Or do they drift away after a while, like an old friend gone?
They do drift away, actually. Somebody asked me to do a Borat impression the other day. And I did one, and they said, it was actually somebody in the street, and they said, that's terrible. That's one of the worst Borat impressions.
Who do you think you are? Aren't.
So once I've done the film, I kind of never watch it again. So Borat, because I'm in the edit, and I end up seeing the film hundreds of times, once it's locked, I can't really bear to watch it again. In case I go, oh, wait a minute, I should have actually removed that scene or that.
The watch it again, I can totally get. Somehow I have gained a real respect for your performance talent. I'm sure you could summon them if you really needed to. What do you call the kind of, or how do you describe the kind of comedy that you, I don't know if you stumbled into it or you designed it like, you know, Leonardo, but you came up with this, you know, find a character, take him into the real world and expose things. How did you come to that?
Honestly, I wish I could say that it was an intentional thought, an intentional plan. It was totally accidental. I was doing a live TV show in England on a cable network in England. And I was doing these characters. I was pre-recording characters. I would shoot in the morning these characters and then do the live show in the afternoon.
In other words, characters like Ali G.
Ali G. So I had an early form of Ali G called MC Jocelyn Cheadle Hume.
Okay.
And he was a member of the upper class, but he wanted to be a, you know, gangster rapper.
Mm-hmm.
So there were similarities with Ali G. I went out to shoot some stuff, and then I saw some real skateboarders. I had a skateboard, and I was with this the director of the show, and I said, shall I go and speak to those guys? And he goes, yeah. Go for it. So I went, I started doing some skateboarding stuff, and they start going, oh man, you was whack. That's rubbish, man. And I carried on with them. And then at one point I stopped and I go, you do realize I'm joking, right?
Yeah.
And they were shocked. And then a tourist bus turned up and I looked to the director. He looked at me. I jumped on the tourist bus, got to the
Keep
top.
It going.
To
it, Stay
took
in
over the mic. Yeah. Then we got off. We passed Tower Bridge. I got off, went into some big business claim that my dad was upstairs and the manager of the company.
And you're still in character at this
still
point?
Still in character.
Like hip-hop skater street?
So I carried on, then went into a pub, started breakdancing in the pub. They called the police, went back to the studio. The director started cutting the stuff. I went live on air. We cut to the first VT, videotape, as we called it there. It was really good. Then cut to the second one. It was really good. I'm doing an interview a bit like you are with me.
Yeah.
Cut to the third one, blank. There was nothing there. At the end of the show, I was summoned to the head of the channel. And he said,
What are you doing?
He said, what are you doing? You're never going to do that again on this channel. You're going to get us sued. And, you know, you do that again, you're going to be sacked. And at that point, I realized I was onto something.
And that first something was ultimately Ali G.
Yes, exactly.
You named him Ali G. It was a kind of a foreign flavor to it. You could have called him a lot of things. You did that. Why? Were you already on to the fact that if you gave it a little bit of a foreign flavor, you had more leeway, more room to run? I mean, many Britons, they might be Ali. There are plenty of active Muslims, but still.
So, well, the idea was that it would be ambiguous. Ali G could be Alistair, but it could be, you know, he could be foreign. He could be Pakistani. Mm-hmm. He could be from India. So the idea was it was playing on the prejudice of the people that we were meeting. So we were meeting members of the English establishment who were generally upper class and were totally disassociated from British street culture. And the assumption was that they would have prejudices about a guy who came in dressed in clothes that they did not recognize, who had a name of a name which had a slight a slight ethnic flair to it. Mm-hmm. That they would assume that he could actually be more stupid than other people. Mm-hmm. So.
So work with that presumption.
Yes, exactly.
And you've got room to run.
Exactly.
The UK. I mean, look, class is everywhere. The United States has become more class-oriented. UK has all long been very class-oriented. What's your background? What's your class? Where do you fit into British society?
Yes, well, essentially, I mean, I've never revealed this before, but I'm actually Jewish.
No, never revealed before.
Exactly. No, so, I think that's an interesting thing because I...
But, is that a class?
Well, class changes if you're an immigrant. So... You know, three generations ago, when my great-grandfather arrived in Wales, he was a rag-and-bone man. You know, he'd go around the streets asking for spare scraps of metal so he could sell them. So, you know, theoretically, then you're working class. And then over the generations, I think we became, you know, what would be called middle class or possibly upper middle class. And then, but I think class... It's a fluid thing in immigrant communities.
Does it inform your humor, or is it more a Jewish childhood in the UK? I don't know.
I think there is. I think in England you are aware of class. Mm-hmm. And I went to a university where there was a clear delineation between the classes there. So there were...
Cambridge.
Yes, so there were people who came from public schools, and in England, public schools
means private or fancy.
Yes, exactly, where they're boarding and they're associated with the elites. And then there were people who came from comprehensives or state schools and independent schools. And there was a divide, so it was the first time that I was coming up against those kind of people because you didn't really meet them beforehand. And I think that, you know, I think why Ali G... took root and became so popular so quickly was it was a challenge to the upper class and to the establishment of England. So it became popular very, very quickly with the black communities, the Asian communities, and the working class in England.
You were kind of representing for...
Yes, and interestingly enough, because I never gave interviews as myself, and I still haven't given a single interview
rare.
In England... Each of those classes and each of those ethnic groups claimed me as their own. So at the beginning, the black community thought, oh, yeah, he's one
that's
of
our
us.
Guy.
The, you know, the Asian community
And they
said,
really didn't know. Who knew?
Yes, no one knew. And the Asian or, you know, the Indian Pakistani community said, yeah, he's one of us. The Turkish community thought he was one of us. I actually, very early on, I got a... Ali G got successful enough that I received my first death threat from a group called Combat 18, who are affiliated with the National Front, which is the British kind of neo-Nazi
hard right. Yeah.
Yes. And they said, listen, they wrote this letter which said, listen, we know who you are. We know who you are. We know that you're Greek. And we know you don't live in...
We're on to you. Here's the thing. I always wonder if you're championing those whose sort of garb you take on. This time it's a soccer hooligan, or mocking. And it's you don't make it an easy line to figure out. Were you championing those who might be represented by Ali G or mocking them? Are you championing sort of lower class public housing mob in this new film, or mocking?
That's a very interesting question. I think you've got to have a look at those characters as specific individuals. So they don't actually represent anyone. There's nobody who is actually as stupid as Ali G. You know, Ali G wasn't necessarily representing the sort of ethnic, hip-hop loving, you know, kid.
Is a stand-up, no matter what.
And that's why, you know, when Bruno came out, which was a movie I wrote about, a gay Austrian fashion reporter, there was criticism that it was mocking, you know, gay people internationally, mm-hmm. where in fact it was a very specific character, that of a gay Austrian neo-Nazi fashion reporter.
Sacha Baron Cohen is with us in the studio. His new movie out next month, The Brothers Grimsby. We'll look at that. Of course, it's not all Ali G and Borat and Bruno. Here he was as Pirelli, Sweeney Todd's rival barber. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
To shave the face, to trim the beard, to make the bristle, glitter the whistle. This is from early infancy, the talent give to me, my God. He take the skill, he take the brains, he take the will, to take the pains. He take the bass, he take the...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with actor, comedian, movie maker, provocateur, Sacha Baron Cohen, he of Ali G and Borat and Bruno, about his provocative work and his latest film, out next month, The Brothers Grimsby. He plays a soccer hooligan whose long-lost brother is a kind of James Bond-style super spy. When they get together to take on the world, all kinds of mayhem ensues. You can imagine, or maybe you can't. You can join us this hour. Do you love the work of Sacha Baron Cohen? Does he make you think? Is he exposing uncomfortable truths, making a career off them, or both? What's your favorite Sacha Baron Cohen persona? Ali G, Borat, Bruno? Why? His 2003 The Ali G Show, Sacha Baron Cohen sat down as Ali G with astronaut Buzz Aldrin, and you've seen many versions of this encounter. Here's a clip.
Check it out, I is here with none other than my main man, Buzz Aldrin. I know this is a sensitive question, but what was it like not being the first man on the moon? Was you ever jealous of Louis Armstrong?
It was Neil Armstrong, and no, I was not jealous. He was a very, very qualified person, yeah.
Do you think man will ever walk on the sun?
No. The sun is too hot. It is not a good place to go to.
What happens if they went in winter when the sun is cold?
The sun is not cold in the winter.
And on. Many versions of that interaction. I laughed till I cried many, many times. Flash forward, it's The Brothers Grimsby. There's a little bit of the trailer, a trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. Check it out. Here, Nobby, played by Sacha Baron Cohen, seated across the table from me here, rallies a group of kids to help distract the gunman trying to kill his brother, Sebastian. Nobby is from the really grim little town of Grimsby. The kids are street urchins, let's say. Sebastian's super spy needs help, but here's the interaction.
Oh, God, I'm cornered. Should never have come here alone.
You're never alone in Grimsby, Ruff.
Lads!
See those blokes out there? Oh, those are Manchester United supporters.
How dare those show up here?
You delay them, I promise I'll burn your school down for you.
Sacha Baron Cohen in the new film, The Brothers Grimsby. Tell us a story here. Nobby is soccer hooligan, kind of the slob who's just obsessed with soccer, and his brother disappeared a long time ago, and he's kind of James Bond.
Yes. Right? Well, I wouldn't say he's a soccer hooligan. Essentially what Donald Trump would refer to people as a scrounger. He's somebody who is on welfare. He has 9 illegitimate children with his girlfriend, who's played by the wonderful Rebel Wilson.
Yeah.
And he claims various disabilities for them. One of them is called Luke because he claims that he's got leukemia.
They shave his head and say the boy has leukemia.
Yes. And really, actually, he ends up being the hero of our movie. And it's... at the moment, these kind of people in England certainly are being vilified as criminals. You know, there's an...
moochers or...
Yes, there's an attempt to say anybody who, in inverted commas, takes from society doesn't add anything to society. And so there are, you know, huge sections of England and huge sections of the world, actually, which are slightly written off. You know, as we see this... magnetism of people towards the cities. There's huge areas of a lot of industrial countries that are now neglected, and Grimsby is one of those places.
So it gets pretty scroungy, as you say, in their realm. I got a little bit here. You mentioned Rebel Wilson, who plays his wife. She's very full-figured, and she comes home. They've been apart. She's ready to go. All the kids all over the house in the living room. She's ready to... get right to it with Sacha Baron Cohen as her husband, Nobby.
Hiya.
Is that the love of my life, don't I?
I missed you so much.
Me too.
Right, kids, out. Now.
Listen to your mum, out quick.
I got something very important that I need to tell your dad.
What is it?
I lost my panties.
And off it goes. It's Sacha Baron Cohen front to back. Alan's calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Alan, you're on the air with Sacha Baron Cohen.
Hey, Sacha. Huge fans of both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My question is for you, Sacha. Why do you pick on Alabama so much, specifically with Bruno? Does it have to do with the homophobic tendencies? I mean, I love the skit that you did at the University of Alabama and in Coleman, Alabama, to be specific. And, of course, we all know that you did play a gay NASCAR driver in Talladega Nights. I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
What's up, Sacha Baron Cohen? Why do you pick on Alabama?
Why Alabama? Well, I don't think I pick on Alabama, but it's true. We have shot some of the scenes in Alabama. There was one scene in the Ali G show where I think it was an Alabama football game in Tuscaloosa. And Bruno, which was this gay Austrian fashion reporter character, in that guise, I went on the field... and I joined the cheerleaders and started dancing. And the crowd started booing.
Yeah. And it was a pretty outrageous spectacle.
Yes, the crowd started booing. And then I'd hired a bodyguard that day because I was advised it was going to get a little bit rough. And I thought, I'm going to be fine. The bodyguard's going to look after me. I turned around and I saw the back of the bodyguard's head as he was running out of the stadium. And then
his judgment.
The cameraman came over to me and he said, listen, just so you know, you're not going to get out of here because these people are going to fight you until they can fight no more. So then one of the cops came over who was at the stadium. He said, all right, I'm going to put you into the stands. I go, no, I got nothing. You don't understand.
Into the stands. Describe how you were dressed and the affect you were presenting to the stadium.
So I was... I was dressed in a, you know, a sort of high fashion but very camp way. Mm-hmm. And I think...
You were doing the sort of full-on
persona. Yeah, I was joining the...
crazy camp.
Yes, it was extremely camp. And it was there to, you know, I was there to provoke the audience. However, the police then said they were going to put me out into the stands, and I
were they threatening you with that? Was it obvious to you?
I don't think they were threatening.
They were just to get off the field.
Not to get off the field. Put me in with the fans.
Yeah.
But I think they knew that the fans would take care of me.
Yeah.
So I managed to stay on the field, and I ended up switching clothes with the cameraman. You know, I found a tiny dark area that the fans couldn't see me. I switched clothes with him. And I sort of hobbled out. I, you know, lowered my body. I made myself about 5 foot five. Yeah. I had a limp.
Yeah.
And I walked through the crowd, actually, while they were looking somewhere else.
For you, for the other
unfortunately,
was...
the cameraman got beaten to death. No. And this goes out to him.
No.
But as for Alabama, you know, firstly, you know, I've got a lot of affection for the people in Alabama. I shot Talladega Nights there. But there is, you know, there is homophobia there. There is, you know, in states that have a history of civil rights abuses, and obviously Birmingham, Alabama is a, you know,
famous.
Is famous.
Mm-hmm.
Civil rights abuses, racism tends to go hand in hand with homophobia. I'm in no way saying that Alabama now is a particularly racist place, but at that point we thought if we wanted to find a homophobia, you know, a shorthand to finding those places were places where which had become famous for their racial attitudes 40 years or 50 years beforehand.
Can you tell us, I mean, I'm getting listeners here on Twitter. Brian says, this is what Sacha Baron Cohen really sounds like? You know, people
no,
are...
No, the reality, this is my voice. I was put on like a really posh, classy voice because, you know.
It's very classy. But, of course, it's more than the voice. It's the risks you take, both physically and in the characters that you adopt. And it's, I mean, you go so far out there so quickly. What is the source of your rocket fuel? When you get into that mode where you're going to do full-on Borat or full-on Bruno, you're going to take that risk. You're somehow coming like a laser in on the thing that will be most upsetting to people, and in their upset, they'll reveal themselves. What's the fuel that drives you then? Is it something in personal experience? Is it something in theatrical training? Where does it come from?
I think the ultimate drive is to be funny, and I will do anything for a good joke. I wouldn't risk my life.
That's careerism? You're risking? Yeah, you're...
No, I don't think I've ever really risked my life. I've taken a very, very... I've taken calculated risks. Mm. So, for example, you know, we went to Arkansas, and I was also playing this, playing Bruno in the movie. Mm-hmm. We would then assess if I was, you know, if the scene was I was going into a bar and I knew I was going to try and get a boyfriend there, mm-hmm. and it'd be a biker bar.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would not be popular.
Yeah, so we'd know it would not be popular. So, you know, I would take some risks. So we'd do an analysis of the bar, find out, you know, if there had been any fatal shootings,
mm-hmm.
how many there had been. Then we'd try and get an assessment of how many people had guns on them. I'd send someone in beforehand, try and find out how many people, mm-hmm. you know, were armed. Then we'd try and take the guns off them, which is actually very, very difficult in a place like
Absolutely.
Arkansas. And so then you kind of do an assessment. You go, okay, what are the risks? And if things go bad, is there a way to get out of there? So before you actually do the scene, those movies become less about the acting and they're more about how do we get away with achieving the scene and getting out of the scene. So you work out where your exits are. We have a car with the door open that's running.
Ready to go.
So I know exactly if things go off, I know which exit to go through, and we know to go very, very far.
I have to say, watching along with the screening last night, they showed a little bit of a clip of this was when you went to visit white supremacist Glenn Miller in Arkansas, somewhere in that area. And this was backstage kind of, or off camera, like how it all happened. You had it planned out almost like a SWAT team visit, or I recognized it from journalism, you know, that I've done in Rwanda or Somalia or the Balkans, when you are in a very dicey situation. You have to really think through what you're going for, how you're going to get in, get it, and get out. You were planning it just in that way. As a journalist watching that vaccines part, I had a kind of real admiration for. I know you were going for something different, but you were also deliberately trying. You were very clear in what you were trying to expose in the case of that particular individual, but maybe often.
Yes. I mean, you know, we try and plan stuff as much as we can. So there's, I know I'm going back to Bruno a lot. I think maybe it was because it ended up being the most dangerous of the films. But there's a scene at the end that I actually really like, which is, it's a scene where Bruno reunites with his boyfriend, mm-hmm. his assistant, mm-hmm. and it's a climactic end to any romantic comedy where, you know, boy meets girl, boy splits up from girl, boy gets reunited with girl. So we get reunited, but it's at a cage fighting match. And instead of being a girl, it's a boy, you know. Yeah. So we knew the aim was we would have this fight and we would end up kissing and making love. And we thought, where's the best place to do that? We thought, okay, in Arkansas with 2,000 very rowdy people around us. Yeah. And so we did it one night in Texarkana. And so the challenge was, how do we, again, you know, so it's the final scene of the movie. You have to achieve all the story beats. You have to close all the story ends. In the
movie. It is a classic structure you're trying to fill with something very. Oh.
But the problem is, what you're doing is borderline legal. Mm-hmm. So prior to the scene, we have a legal team who are actually based in India.
You mean public kissing or the provocation of a crowd that could lead to violence? Or
there are a few things. So there's, if you cross a state line to incite a riot, that's a federal offense.
Okay.
So the Chicago 7 were actually tried for that.
Yes.
So the problem was, I was crossing a state line to incite a riot. So the question was how to achieve that without going to jail. So we chose Arkansas because we knew the crowd would be good. Mm. By good, I mean they would get angry. And we knew that their state laws on indecency were ambiguous. So there was actually some mistakes in the drafting of their legislation, which meant that it was ambiguous as to how much you could show. So we advertised actually the cage fight by saying, with some pictures of some scantily clad women saying, warning, there will be nudity. So we didn't say it would be male nudity.
Right,
and the audience thought the assumption was it would be female nudity. And so the problem was the first night that I did it, you know, my lawyer said to me, he said, whatever you do, do not incite the audience, don't provoke them.
I mean, verbally.
Yes.
Explicitly.
So the problem was the first night I did it, my boyfriend in the movie comes in, we have a fight, and the crowd started booing because he started bleeding.
Yeah, yeah.
It was fake blood, but the crowd bought it. And so in character, unfortunately, I got a little bit too into character, and I shouted, okay, what are you guys going to do about it? If any of you are tough enough, come in here and I'm going to beat the... I won't say the word out of you.
Yeah.
Thinking that I was completely
safe. This is
safe.
Bruno speaking.
Yeah. I thought I was completely safe in this cage.
Mm.
Within 3 seconds, this huge sort of giant of a man had stood up and started running towards the cage. I thought, I'm fine. There's no way he's getting over the cage. I'm in a cage. He's never going to.
Yeah.
Within 2 seconds, he'd leapt into the cage. He'd done a somersault. He was obviously an amateur ultimate fighter. Stood up, cheered. He was half a foot taller than me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I realized at that point that the cage, which had been designed to keep people out, was actually going to keep me inside
with him.
And at that point, these metal chairs started landing inside the cage. Luckily, I designed an escape hatch, which I jumped through. But my co-writer of the movie, who's actually here in the studio, he sort of met me in, there was a little tiny tunnel underground.
Yeah.
He ran and said, go out,
go back
into the back into the cage and finish the scene. This is the end of the movie. You can't run out.
Yeah.
And I said, well, listen, there's a huge guy in there who wants to rip me apart, and he will. And there are people throwing metal chairs, and there are 2,000 people who want to kill me now. So he said, all right. I go, listen, if the bodyguard, because I had hired a bodyguard that day, I go, if he says I can go in there without being hospitalized, then I'll do it. If I'm only going to get some blows and not go to hospital for a considerable amount of time, I'll do it.
So that's where the line is.
Where the bodyguard poked his head in and he said, you're going to hospital. Let's go. And we ran out into the wedding car and zoomed off.
This time out, it's the soccer mayhem that ensues in the Brothers Grimsby. Sacha Baron Cohen is star of the new film. Mark Strong plays the kind of James Bond-style brother. He's played all kinds of things. Sacha Baron Cohen behind us from the Madagascar soundtrack. He's with me in the studio. You can join us. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I like to move it, move it. He like to move it, move it. She like to move it, move it. You like to move it.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
Us? Can you do us like to? Us like to move it, move it. That's the one. Like to move it, move it. Us like to move it, move it. Us like to move it, move it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm in the studio with Sacha Baron Cohen. He of Ali G and Borat and Bruno. His new film out in the U.S. next month is The Brothers Grimsby. Soccer guy, kind of loser in Trump terms, and his super spy, James Bond-style brother and their interaction. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you ready to see? Sacha Baron Cohen is a good-hearted, dim-witted soccer fan with a James Bond brother at his side saving the world. What do you want next from Sacha Baron Cohen, he who shifts shape and takes on so many, many targets? Let's listen back for just a second here. I mean, it gets very real when he gets out and got out in the middle of the real world. 2006 comedy Borat, posing as Borat, the journalist from faux journalist from Kazakhstan, attends a rodeo, riles up the crowd while wearing an American flag button-up shirt.
My name is Borat. I come from Kazakhstan. Can I say first, we support your war of terror. May we show our support to our boys in Iraq. May USA kill every single terrorist. May George Bush drink the blood of every single man, woman, and child of Iraq.
And the crowd goes wild. Marcos, in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts, you are on the air with Sacha Baron Cohen.
Hello.
Hi, Tom. Mr. Cohen, you are absolutely brilliant, sir.
Oh, thank you very much.
My friends and I have been following you for a very long time, and I just wanted to say really quickly, though Ali G is my favorite character, there was once an episode you did, and I won't say the congressman's name on the air, but it was the bit where you interviewed the congressman from Mississippi. And, you know, what I wanted to say is I think anybody who is anti-Trump at this point, if they really want to win this campaign, they should hire you as a consultant to really read up what the true Trump supporter is and what they represent. And I will take my answer off the air.
Are you deep enough in American politics to run with that? Sacha Baron Cohen?
Deep enough to run with
what's a Trump profile? How you see them? Are you going to?
Well, you got to remember, I'm an Englishman. I'm not actually a citizen here, so I won't give my own opinions about the political race. I just my only thing that I would say is that, and listen, I've succeeded from this. Using this philosophy is sometimes being offensive leads to publicity. It doesn't necessarily mean that what you're saying is correct. And I think Trump is a smart guy and he said so many offensive things that it seems more than a coincidence and it seems a technique and a plan. So,
I mean, this sounds very funny coming from you. I mean, it's been your...
Yes, but I'm trying to be a comedian. I'm trying to get people to laugh by saying absurd, ludicrous things. I'm not trying to become president.
You spend a lot of time in LA now. Why?
Well, I went to LA to make the Ali G show and then to make Borat. I then moved over my writers from England to help write Borat and Bruno and the characters.
But you're, in a way, choosing to live a lot of your life there. Is living in America pleasant for you, more pleasant than living in the UK, or is it all about where, I don't know, the movie stuff happens?
Well, listen, I actually love America. I think it's an incredible place. It certainly has been a land of opportunity for me. It was also actually legally a lot easier for me to make my stuff here because of your First Amendment rights. And because of the degree that you have almost total freedom of speech. So in England, there were severe restrictions with doing my comedy. So Ali G originally was deemed illegal by the channel. Because
in the UK.
Yes, so they originally wanted me to go in the interviews and say, this is a comedy program.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to explain to the lawyers, wait a minute, if I do that, the joke doesn't work.
Yeah.
So originally, when we started doing Ali G in England for a channel called Channel 4, at the end, I would have to say, you have to realize that, you know, some of these questions may appear humorous. But I would say it was at the end, and the guys said, oh yeah, obviously some of them could be conceived as humorous. So legally, we found ways to appease the lawyers and the legal restrictions within British broadcasting and to get the comedy across. But I think it's an amazingly positive society here. I mean, every society has its challenges. We have our challenges in England as well. There are things wrong in every society.
Boy, for somebody who thinks that, you sure managed to find some of the funkiest edges of American society to portray in your movies. It's very entertaining and illuminating, but still.
Yes. Well, I think that's the case, you know, when I was doing it in England as well. So, you know, I've generally tried not to get extremists. So you mentioned a clip the other day where I interviewed a neo-Nazi. Mm-hmm. And the problem is generally those clips haven't made it to air. You know, the worst of the worst don't make it to the air.
Because they're palpably so fringe that it doesn't matter, or they're not as funny? Or
they do matter, but at the end of the day, you don't want to give a platform for people to to share their virulent, hateful views.
He went off you on want to Jews with you in that encounter, from what I saw last night.
Yes, well, I was this neo-Nazi. I was trying to convince him, you know, why don't you get Woody Allen to be, you know, the head of your organization? He goes, because Woody Allen is a Jew. This particular guy ended up
He murdered someone in Kansas City.
Yes, he went to a Jewish community center and shot three people.
Yeah, it's very sad. And yes. He's in prison.
Yes. Well, he had come out of prison when I met him, and he definitely had the air of somebody who could kill, you know, and I've met a few of those people over the years. And you sense there's definitely you have an unease when you're with them in the room. Yeah. And the problem was in that particular scene, the idea was,
say, you're standing in your like thong underwear in his living room after a series of hijinks.
Well, the way we got there actually was, the idea was I was wearing these white trousers, I send out my assistant to get some wheatgrass juice in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. He comes back, my assistant accidentally spills the wheatgrass juice on my
white trousers. Yeah.
And I go, I've got to take these off. These are Dolce & Gabbana's there. Given to me by Stefano himself, they're €5,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Takes them off, dry clean them now. Find a dry cleaner. I don't know how you have to get it.
And suddenly you're half naked.
And suddenly I'm in my cheese
living room.
Yeah. And I say to the guy, I go, listen, take me around your house. I want to know how neo-Nazis live. Show me around. Next thing I know, I'm in his bedroom.
Yeah.
And my boyfriend in the character, who's this 5'4" Filipino guy, walks in and says, what's going on? Okay, I see. Okay, you've been,
you guys have been fooling
around. I go, it's not what it looks like. He goes, wait a minute. You're in your G-string in his bedroom. What's been going on? And then it became a little bit violent.
And yeah. And you're in Sacha Baron Cohen land. Jessica in Harrisonburg, Virginia, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Mm-hmm. A super big fan of Sacha Baron Cohen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. I love you in Les Mis as the innkeeper. You just like nailed that. I love that.
My question is this.
So I'm a feminist and I love your work, but there are moments, especially I think it was in Borat, when he was taking pictures in my lap, you know, taking pictures of these women over the bathroom stall. But it's not funny. You know? So part of me feels like a bad feminist laughing at this. And I just wonder, you know, what you can say about sort of your portrayal of women.
So say that again. You found them funny or you didn't find them funny?
I did find them funny, but I sort of felt like a bad feminist in finding them funny.
And why was that? Can I ask? I mean, I'm going to do some amateur psychology here. Why did you feel bad about yourself that you laughed at that joke?
Because it was like violating their privacy. I mean, obviously you're in character, but violating their privacy, taking pictures of them going to the bathroom, right?
Yes. But they weren't, those were actresses. So,
I know.
Or I should say actors. Sorry. I should say actors. And I would say, listen, I'm a feminist as well. I think, you know, women should have equal rights. I'm a father of two young women. I think, you know, if you look at Borat, he espouses a variety of hateful views. You know, he hates Jews. Mm-hmm. He thinks women are extremely inferior. He thinks gypsies should be kept in camps. I mean, almost every view that he espouses is hateful. So, you know, I think you're asking yourself the same question as sort of Jewish people ask themselves when watching Borat, when Borat was saying anti-Semitic stuff. But I think the fact that...
You mean, is this exposing a problem or is this promoting a problem?
Yes. Well, I think the reality was members of those minorities laughed at those gags.
Yeah.
Because this was a character who was clearly letting people open themselves up to reveal their innermost prejudices. And that was actually how I came about with it. The first time I ever did Borat was I went to a fox hunting rally. It was years ago. It was about 19 years ago.
Pro or anti? Anti, I assume.
Fox hunting rally. I went as Borat. Okay. I do not hunt foxes. Yes. So this, by the way, members mainly of the upper class.
Yes, of course.
And I was going around with Borat just going, oh, it's fantastic you hunt the fox in Kazakhstan. At that point, he was Moldovan. In Moldova, we hunt a Jew. You think we should hunt a Jew? And, you know, and some of them go, well, I think, yes. I mean, possibly, yeah. I mean, it could be if there are too many. And I realized at that point that people would open up more if they believed that their peers would never see the interview.
This was going to air in Moldova. Who cares?
Exactly. So we would set up companies, so Moldovan television, so that these people felt, okay, I can tell the truth finally because my peers are never going to see it. I'm never going to get in trouble. Now, it's now a different age because of the internet, and you know there's no real privacy. But I think you are safe in laughing at that joke. I don't think you're a bad person for laughing at that joke. I don't think you're not a feminist for laughing at that joke because, firstly, it was funny. And secondly, it was an extreme, hateful character who we are ultimately laughing at. None of us would actually want to live in a house with Borat. He's fine for 85 minutes, but we don't, you know, he's lovable, but he actually, you know, espouses and sprouts some of the most hateful stuff possible. Has that answered it at all? I don't know, Jessica,
are you satisfied?
Yeah, can I ask one more question? I mean, in Bruno, you did this brilliant, I think it was Bruno, interview with some first-wave feminists. Was that Bruno?
That was Borat, I think.
Oh my God, Borat,
where he finds out about Pamela Anderson.
It's brilliant, you know, that, and I actually show that to some of my students. I teach them in studies, and that's hysterical, because you're very clearly, you know, playing with, you know, feminist stereotypes. But yeah, I guess the question, and you answered it okay, was, you know, where you draw the line, but I guess that's the question all around.
Way out there is the answer, but it appears to work. Jessica, I really appreciate your call. This is scripted this time with the Brothers Grimsby. It's not you taking a character out into the world. Are you tired of doing that? You've got kids now. It's too much risk in doing that. Are the studios not up for that anymore? We saw what happened after the movie The Interview, and North Korea apparently hacked into Sony and exposed all this stuff. I've heard you remark on this. Are the studios afraid to let you go off and insult Kazakhstan or North Korea, whoever might be next?
I think, and it's a sad fact, that North Korea actually won. By hacking into Sony, and probably my bosses, people I work for at Sony will be upset that I'm talking
about
this.
Thanks a lot, Sasha.
What are you doing?
Yeah.
We told you just to tell them it was funny. Unfortunately, North Korea won. Because what they were trying to do was to intimidate. And it's what terrorist organizations do as well. It's what, you know, ISIS, you know, attack Charlie Hebdo because Charlie Hebdo are mocking them.
Mocking them, mm-hmm.
What you can do, if you're a totalitarian state and you live in a dictatorship and you have extreme censorship, how do you impose your censorship internationally? The way you do that is through terrorism and through intimidation. So North Korea did it through cyber terrorism. They basically made it clear that anyone who mocks their leader will be destroyed. And the end result of that was the chairman of Sony Pictures got sacked. They hacked into her personal emails. She got
lots of exposure, uncomfortable exposure.
Yes. And they succeeded. And I think the rest of the studios in Hollywood are now more wary because they all know that their cyber systems are subject to attack. And if North Korea can do it, any other country can do it, and probably any other organization. So people are now wary what they're writing in emails, and they're wary what they're actually paying money to make. And I think that's a shame. I wonder, and I really wonder, if I had gone into Fox now as a niche British comedian and said, listen, I want to make a movie where I'm playing a documentary reporter from a real country, whether they would say, listen, let's not call it Kazakhstan, let's call it Katakistan, let's not make it, let's not make anything that could be construed as real. And I think that's a shame because, you know, this is a great country. This is a country where there's freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and that leads to great freedom within art. And I think we should fight to maintain that freedom and not to be intimidated by the bullies that exist around the world.
There are scenes in the new film, at least the cut I saw last night, The Brothers Grimsby, which must challenge, you just got half a minute here, must challenge the people who watch out for the public sensibility, vulgarity, and all the rest. Is that a final cut? Is everything I saw last night really going to be in there? Because there's some pretty outrageous stuff.
Well, we've been negotiating with the MPAA, who are the people who are responsible for your...
decency.
For your decency, to make sure that you are not offended. And they are, they're some of the funniest negotiations I've ever had, you know. So you're actually arguing the amount of frames you can have about genitalia or... And don't worry, there's not too much genitalia.
Oh, wow, I don't know about that.
Well, not human genitalia anyway. but, you know, ultimately, I don't think there's anything truly offensive that I wouldn't want, you know, young people to watch in this movie. And maybe that's because I'm a sick man. But.
Ladies and gentlemen, watch out for your own. When Sacha Baron Cohen is at work. What a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much,
The Brothers Grimsby. Thank you so much for coming in. Great to meet you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
Sacha Baron Cohen with us. The movie is The Brothers Grimsby. Remember him in Les Mis? Here he is, master of the house. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Sacha Baron Cohen in the studio. This is On Point. But nothing gets you nothing. Everything has got a little crush. Master of the house, keeper of the zoo. Ready to relieve them off a stew or two. Ordering the wine, making up the weight. Picking up their knickknacks when they can't see straight. Everybody loves a landlord. Everybody's bosom friend. I didn't ever please this Jesus when I plead him in the end.